Welcome to the February 8th post-Super Bowl edition of Mountain Money. I'm Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Doug Wells. Morning, Doug.
Good morning. Always fun to be in the studio the day after Super Bowl Sunday.
And we had a spectacular weekend in Park City, you know, with lots of snow for once, and the slopes were crowded. I don't know if you got out. Did you get out at all this weekend?
I did not get out skiing, but I did get out to enjoy the beautiful weather.
And this morning, we're going to welcome back a former co-host of Mountain Money, Jill Scheuer, who's got a new book out called Conquer Sticky Situations, which empowers readers to conquer the stickiest situations they may encounter at work. She's got a lot of interesting tools and thoughts on that.
And we're welcoming back Jill, as Roger just shared. We're also welcoming back Tiffany Sue, who is a reporter with the New York Times. And she's going to join Mountain Money to talk with us about last night's Super Bowl ads. We had a great conversation with her last year, and we're looking forward to this year's. And we're going to end the hour talking with CNBC senior contributor Michael Santoli about the frenzy over GameStop's share stock and all the frenzy that's taking place there.
Welcome back to Mountain Money to Jill Scheuer. Jill is the founder of Expedition HR Consulting, who has published her first book called Conquer Sticky Situations. Sorry about that. The book empowers the reader to conquer the stickiest situations you encounter. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning, Roger. Nice to hear your voice.
It's nice to hear yours as well. Jill, let's start by, you know, setting the context. What is a sticky situation?
Great. Thanks for diving right in. So what I define a sticky situation is any conversation, situation that's either uncomfortable, awkward, basically one you stress about dealing with, might give you sleepless nights or headaches or that type of thing. So there's a big bucket of things that can fall into the sticky situations definition.
And let's give an example or two to sort of bring it to give it some context for people. Give us an example of a sticky situation.
Definitely. Yeah, well, since the book is catered to kind of small businesses and sticky situations in small businesses, one that is probably one of the most dreaded that I've experienced in my career is having to address a body odor or body hygiene issue with an employee. That's a kind of a really uncomfortable situation. Another one might be just in life. You know, you have someone maybe that is always asking for favors or always asking to borrow money. And so that falls into the sticky situation bucket as well and just makes you feel really uncomfortable and makes you put you in a place where you feel like you have to say something. And it's not an easy conversation to broach.
And your book really lays the foundation. There's really five aspects you need to think through to have a successful conversation. Let's start there. Can you give us an overview of what those five steps are, and then we'll dig into each of those?
Absolutely. So, like you say, there's five steps as kind of a framework, and my kind of disclaimer is use this as a framework and don't get tied to each step. It's a great way to frame the conversation, like I mentioned, and but it's not every situation won't fit all of these five steps. So the first one is to say thanks. I'm a big fan of gratitude and just saying thanks for meeting with you, whether you're at work with an employee of yours or say it's that neighbor who's always asking for the favors. And you're just thanking them for being there and for being willing to have the conversation. And so from there, the second step is just tell them right off the bat why you're having the conversation, you know, like a termination in the workplace. You'd want to just say, we're here because we're letting you go today. Or if you're talking with someone about maybe body odor, you'd say, we're here to talk about something that may be uncomfortable and it relates to your hygiene in the workplace. Because you want to get it right out there. The third step is exactly kind of what is the issue. You don't want to dance around it. You want to say exactly what the issue is in few words, be straightforward. And then going into the fourth step of exactly how you expect things to change. So building off of what the issue is, how you expect it to change so that they know exactly what you're getting at in this conversation. And if you don't get to this point fairly quickly, they're going to lose track of kind of where you're going. So the last step is to say, tell them thanks again for listening, for letting you express this concern, and then asking them if they have any questions, and then turning it over to them. And the key is kind of pausing and letting them respond.
One of the things that I found really helpful about the book, and you know, over the years I've had to do a number of unpleasant conversations along the lines you described, things like, you know, employee terminations, and they are hard. And sort of giving an organizational toolbox that gives you some sort of pillars to turn to, I thought was very useful. In addition to the five steps, you sort of organized this concept of three prongs. Let's talk about the three prongs and how some of them work.
Great. So the first prong is just being simple about what you're saying. I like the words less said, best said. And what falls under that are things such as filler words. I give an example in the book where, like the word actually, just. You can often take out these words and not change the meaning of what you're relaying. So that's one of the biggest tools that clients and people I relay the method to find useful. Also, just repeating yourself, going along with giving the message simply, once you have your message defined as what you're going to say, you don't have to say anything else. You can repeat yourself. And sometimes it feels a little funny, but I always say, wouldn't you rather feel a little funny repeating yourself than introducing something new that you didn't plan to say? So that's kind of a simple piece or simple prong in a nutshell. The second one is being straightforward. I mentioned saying what you need to say and not dancing around it, because you're there to have this really uncomfortable conversation for both sides. And it's going to be hard enough to just broach the conversation, and so just get it out there. I mentioned the example of if you're terminating someone, don't go into the meeting saying, well, you know, we've had issues these last few months, or, you know, you probably have an idea something's going on. That's going to make it more stressful for everybody. So being straightforward, and what I like to call out is, being straightforward is not being brutally honest. I've heard that term so much, and there are people that kind of say, well, that's who I am. I'm brutally honest. And that there's a difference between being straightforward and being brutally honest. Being straightforward is getting the message right out there in few words without any room for, you know, confusion or misinterpretation. And in the book, I give an example of someone I worked with once, and she, you know, didn't understand. She said, that's just who I am. That's how I relay things. And it's just not an effective way. Go ahead, Roger. Were you going to say something? Or Doug?
Actually, it was Doug stepping on your words. But finish your thought, and then I've got a follow-up question.
No, you're fine. So the third piece is being human-centered. And this is my absolute favorite, and it's one of the pillars upon which I built my consulting company. We are all human. There's people that refer to human resources as kind of a people department or the human department, but what I find really interesting is that piece is often forgotten. We go into these conversations with an agenda and, you know, this is the issue, we need it to be fixed, and we have a lot of anger or maybe resentment behind the conversation. And if we just stop and think, we're both human, the person that's giving or relaying the message and the person receiving the message. And gosh, even though there's an issue that needs to be handled, just take a minute to be empathetic and think how this message is going to be received. And I mentioned pausing and just thinking for a minute how it will be received, and maybe even relaying the message and then revisiting it at a later time. That's what it means to me to be human-centered in these types of conversations. And in the book, I talk about just in life, just kind of keeping this in the forefront and being human-centered in your communications and just the way you interact with people at work and in your personal life. And then it becomes more natural when you're in one of these sticky situations to call upon empathy.
Jill, I'm glad you mentioned that, because it's one of the things that I think most of us learn in our time as managers, as leaders in our company, is oftentimes you got in that position because you were a successful individual contributor. And sometimes that means, you know, just putting your head down, getting stuff done and making things happen. And you can forget about, it's easy to forget about your impact on others. And as we get older, I think we realize we become more sensitive, hopefully, as to how others are receiving us and how we have an impact on their lives and how it's so important to have empathy. And I like what you talked about in the sticky situations is get the facts out there, but also be human-centered. I think that's a difficult balance for people sometimes. Any advice for people to help them climb that learning curve to get that empathy and the facts, just the facts, but also the empathy, how to get that balance?
Yeah, I like to say kind of practice in life. So along with the simple part of the three-prong approach is kind of when you have to relay a message, even if it's not in a sticky situation, be thinking of these pieces that can help as far as simplifying when you need to request something from someone at work or in your life, simplify the message, similar to being human-centered. I'll give you an example. When you go to send an email, instead of diving right in saying, hey, Joe, where is the report? You know, I really need it Friday. I hope you're on track with it. Pause and kind of say, hey, Joe, hope you had a good weekend with your family. Hope it was restful. I would love to check in on the status of the report. And it just, as I say, changes the air of the whole conversation and just makes it, it shows them that you actually care about them as a human first. And then you have your, you know, agenda items, so to speak.
One of the things that you just mentioned that really resonated with me was the importance of repeating yourself as a vehicle to avoid getting into things you wish you hadn't said in these conversations. As a lawyer, when I found that I would find these situations where a sticky situation conversation had gone badly, it was often because someone had not taken the time to think through exactly what they wanted to say and stuck to their script. And you talk a lot about scripts and the importance of even practicing how to deal with a sticky situation. What kinds of tips do you have for that? How important is it that you actually rehearse?
Oh, gosh, so important. You mentioned you'd seen it in your career. So important. And the pushback I get, and maybe you or some of the listeners are thinking, okay, that's great, have an idea what you're going to say, but gosh, like, who wants to receive a message from someone in a sticky conversation that sounds scripted? And so I counter that with, right, wouldn't you rather it sound a little scripted than going off track? So it's so important to do a few things. Write down what you're going to say. And I know some people think, gosh, you know, I have it in my head. I know. And I say, write it down, exactly the words you're going to say, because they will sound different on paper than they do when you say them out loud. And I even take it a step further and say, you know, it should be few enough words in this conversation that you should be able to memorize it, but have, if you can have a piece of paper in front of you, again, I'd rather that, even if you glance down at it, if you're sitting across the table from someone, to refer to it, but say these words in front of a mirror and see what your face does, see what your, you know, your hands do. Does it just make you physically awkward to say these things? And if it does, kind of rehearse it, figure out exactly where your hands will be on the table. Will they be, you know, on your legs? Will they be folded in front of you? Think through all these things. And I think these are the pieces that get missed. And that's where the conversation goes off track, because the person delivering the message gets really nervous and they don't have a plan.
And speaking of having a plan, you know, there's a famous saying, Mike Tyson is credited with it. Everybody has a plan until they get hit in the face. Mike Tyson, of course, being a boxer. So you go into the meeting, you're hoping it's going to go well. You've got your script. And then the person that you need to have the conversation with, and Roger, you've had these conversations. I have. Jill, you've probably had many, many of these conversations. There tend to be two types of folks that you deliver this message to. One that kind of wants to improve and wants to hear the feedback and will leave and take that feedback, hopefully in the constructive manner that you had planned for. And then there's folks that no matter what your best planning is, they're going to respond negatively to it. If that happens to you, what do you do?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. That's a very common thing to happen, and the reality is it probably will happen in some of these really heated situations. So one tool, which I like to say first and foremost, which is really simple, if you don't know what to say when someone comes back at you, and I always use the term just lashes out or becomes kind of hostile, just pause the conversation and say, we're going to pause this for a minute. We're going to revisit. I understand this is hard news to take, or this is hard feedback. I'd like to revisit this because, again, I know it's hard feedback to take. Let's take a minute and come back to it. And you're probably doing everyone some favors in that you'll give yourself a chance to regroup and figure out exactly how you want to respond. And you also give the person you're speaking with a chance to compose their thoughts. And you're also setting them up for success in the conversation. We all know that person who gets the feedback that their work performance is not where it needs to be. And they start, as I say, spouting off things that are going to hurt them, or they start putting down their manager or blaming others. So it really is a tool for both sides. Or, you know, the other option is you've thought of these, what I call what if ahead of time. And you think, okay, if they get angry and they start listing off the reasons that this is incorrect information, here's what I'm going to say. And then if that doesn't work, you can say, you know, I'm going to pause the conversation. And you can even use words like, I want both of us to have a minute to just kind of think through best next steps. I don't want either one of us to say things that we don't believe are true, or something like that.
And I really enjoyed how you fleshed out the concept of a powerful pause in the book. One of the things that often happens in the book is the way in which you show that subtle changes in the way you say things can have a significant effect on these kinds of conversations. For example, when you're talking about being straightforward, you say avoid buts and howevers. Let's talk a little bit about what that means and why is that effective?
Sure. So this is one of my favorites, and I always like to say the words but and however have a place in conversation, in sentences. In sticky situation conversations, we have to be aware of them and careful with them. They can often negate the sentence. So, hey, Joe, you're a very valuable member of the team, and we love having you work with us. You contribute such great ideas, but you seem to have some trouble getting into work on time, and you've missed a lot of work, so these are the things I need to change. Versus, Joe, you're a valuable member of the team. You always have valuable contributions. I'd like to talk about your tardiness and the number of absences you've had this year. You see how those two sounded really different?
Yes.
That's what I like to demonstrate is it. I use the term changes the air of the conversation when you end one sentence, pause, start the other. And so that was an example with but. However, works very similarly. And those are two words that I've just seen over and over. And even when we train through a script and what to say, I've seen clients in the workplace say those words and later they think, oh, I felt the way it sounded when I left those words in there. I'm really going to remember to take those out. And even just in, you know, annual performance reviews or when you're talking with employees about, even if it's not quite to the level of a really sticky conversation, just taking them out makes the what you say just more impactful and separates ideas.
So, Jill, we've got 2 minutes left, and one of the questions, you know, we've really been on the company side of this, which is great. It's who the audience, the managers at companies, it's the audience for your book. I do want to take kind of wrap up with this question, which is from the employee standpoint, you know, what advice do you have for the employee that's receiving that? And let's say that there is a reason that needs to be shared, or what advice do you have for employees to take it? And if there's information that they agree with, what's a positive and constructive way to share that?
Yeah, so just to make sure I'm understanding. So if they want to respond to feedback they're given?
Yeah, you know, sometimes there is a rationale as to why something's been happening that maybe the manager's not aware of, and you can lash out, and it can be done in a negative way, or it can be done in a positive way. But just in general, Jill, what feedback or what advice do you have for people receiving this information?
Gotcha. So some words I like to say as kind of keep in your back pocket as an employee, if you ever find yourself in a sticky situation, whether you see it coming or don't see it coming, is thanks for the feedback. As hard as that is to say, sometimes the feedback is really tough to hear. Starting with that changes the air. It shows your professionalism. And then if you're thinking, gosh, I don't have excuses, I actually have reasons why this isn't true. And you probably know I went through that in the book on the difference between an excuse and a reason. And listing out the reasons why you feel this is incorrect, I would highly recommend, though, thanks for the feedback. Could we revisit this tomorrow? I'd like to come back with a couple ideas about how I can improve and a couple things I'd like to share about the feedback you gave me.
That's great advice. And Jill, we miss you here at Mountain Money. It was fun having you as our co-host, and we're glad that you wrote this book. We've been talking with Jill Scheuer. She is the author of the book, Conquer Sticky Situations. Jill, thank you so much for joining us. Fascinating conversation with Jill, and so fun to speak with her again. She was one of our co-hosts, two and a half years ago now?
Yes, actually a little less than that, more like maybe a year and a half. Anyway, it was fun.
It's been a long year, though. Forgive me on that. You know, I think it's an important topic. We're waiting for our next guest to join us by phone, and so Roger and I are just going to revisit this. Roger, when you think back to some of your first management positions, I know I look back, and I'm a little embarrassed at how poor I was at some of this stuff, and I feel bad for my early employees that I had to learn on. I don't know if your experience was similar.
It was, and also one of the things, Doug, that I'm sure you'll appreciate is many of the tough conversations that I had to have as a manager were with lawyers, pretty smart ones. So if you talk about somebody who wants to litigate every point you want to make, okay, if you want to say you did X on this assignment, you did Y on this assignment, they're gonna come up with five reasons why you're wrong. So it was really something that a lot of the tips that she had, I wish I'd had when I did those conversations.
Yeah, and I really like the tip on empathy. One of the things we did not get to talk about is the importance of humor. And I know, Roger, working with you and being on the board with you, I think that's one of the really powerful things about the effectiveness of you as a leader is your ability to inject humor at the right time.
And sometimes at the wrong time, unfortunately. But anyway, Doug, what's going on in the market this morning?
The market's up a little bit. It's as you know, it's been a very strong start to the year. We're two-thirds of the way through earnings season. And Roger, if I had told you a year ago that we'd be going through a pandemic, and what do you think the earnings for the companies are going to be in fourth quarter for the S&P 500? They're actually up versus last year fourth quarter, which is really surprising.
Doug, we talk a lot about the disproportionate impact of the pandemic on the American people. I think there's also been a vastly disproportionate impact of the pandemic on the American corporation. So we talk about the PEs in the S&P 500. Is there this dramatic gap between industries like streaming services on the one hand versus airlines on the other?
Yeah. I mean,
do we see a real distortion?
Absolutely. In fact, I was talking to one of my colleagues at Albion on Friday about this, and he sent me a chart that shows by industry the sectors in the S&P. And the word you used, Roger, dramatic, is exactly what you see. You see the winners really winning and the losers really losing. And maybe that transitions us a little bit, Roger, to our conversation today. I know we've got our guests joining us here hopefully in a few minutes. But Super Bowl commercials, speaking about winners and losers, boy, there really was domination last night. And on one hand, kind of fun to see a 43-year-old quarterback playing at the top of his game as well as he did last night.
It was. And, you know, we're hoping Tiffany's going to join us any minute now. But one of the things that was interesting to me about the ad content of the Super Bowl was the way in which some things were different. I mean, it seems like every year we get to see Tom Brady, we get to see Budweiser Clydesdales, we get to see Coca-Cola polar bears, and we get to see clever ads from Hyundai. And this year, the only one of those four that really showed up was Brady, and boy, did he show up. So it's interesting to me why the choices were made by, why did Budweiser decide to run Anheuser-Busch ads for Bud Light, but not the Budweiser ad? Why did they make that difference? I don't really understand why, what the choices were made. A Super Bowl ad still cost, I want to say, $5.5 million for 30 seconds.
Yeah, I think I saw a number close to that as well, and that's a staggering amount of money. And some of them, I thought, did really, really well, and some of them kind of missed the mark.
There was one ad for this oat milk substitute called Oatly, and it consisted of the CEO sitting in front of a desk singing, "It tastes like milk, it tastes like milk." It was incredibly amateurish. It looked like some guy filmed it on his iPhone. And I got to wonder what it is they thought was worth $5.3 million on that. Others were very effective. But there was just as interesting as the effective ones are the ineffective ones.
And I understand we've got our guest joining us now. We've got Tiffany Sue with the New York Times joining us, and she's a media reporter there. Tiffany, thank you for joining us on Mountain Money.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Roger was just positing a high-level question about how companies could, the ones that missed the mark, how they could be off by so much. And Roger used the example for Oatly, which is, I'm vegan, and I love Oatly milk. It's a great milk. I'm not endorsing them. But Roger, you're right. It was a terrible ad. How does something like that happen?
I mean, people are of mixed opinions on that ad specifically. Some people thought, oh, it was a great representation of pandemic protocols. I mean, the CEO standing alone in a giant field, completely isolated. But you're right. A lot of people saw the ad and they were thinking, why is Oatly advertising in the Super Bowl? And what's interesting is that Oatly actually picked up on this and started selling a T-shirt almost immediately after the ad aired that says across the front, "I totally hated that Oatly commercial."
Good right? for them.
So they're playing both sides. I think the average Super Bowl advertiser knows that there's a good chance some people are going to love their ad, and there's an equally good chance that a lot of people are going to really, really despise it. And at the end of the day, what's valuable for any company that's participating in this huge viewership event is that they're getting attention, right? It's that old adage, you know, any attention is good attention.
One of the things that was interesting to me was the role of the pandemic in the ads that we saw. So, for example, you had a Ford ad that was very, what I would say, pandemic-centric, but almost none of the other ads even sort of gave passing reference to the existence of the pandemic. Why do you think that was?
You know, I was talking to some ad executives last night, one of whom said, "I cannot believe how many of these ads are just completely ignoring the pandemic." And you're right, you know, not a mask in sight. In most of these commercials, a lot of commercials stuck with the age-old Super Bowl tactic of fancy sets, special effects, location changes. And I think what happened was that a lot of the creative teams and brands behind these ads thought, people have been living the pandemic for nearly a year. They don't want to be reminded of it, especially on night when they're turning to the TV for entertainment, right? They want to take their minds off of this terrible, difficult year that they've been through. And so a lot of the development teams for these commercials made the bet that people won't mind if we don't push in their faces the trauma that they've gone through for months, right? What they want is humor. What they want is hope. What they want is, frankly, something kind of silly that they can talk about with their friends and family afterward.
Yeah, humor still sells, as does an emotional pull at your heart. And I thought the two of the car commercials really did that well. I thought Toyota with the Paralympic swimmer, that was an ad that pulled at my heart. And then the humor one, I'm a fan of Will Ferrell's, and so, of course, I like the Will Ferrell commercial. Any thoughts on the role of humor and emotion?
Oh, absolutely. I think a lot of brands went in heavy on humor this year. Actually, what's interesting is there's one ad from Bud Light Seltzer, I think, that mixed humor with references to the pandemic in what I thought was a pretty successful ad, right? They showed lemons falling from the sky and pummeling travelers at an airport, like cardboard cutouts in an empty stadium, you know, people at a wedding. And the whole joke there was, haha, it's been kind of an awful time, but have a lemonade. Make lemonade out of the lemons that have just catapulted into your life. But yeah, in addition to humor, there was a pretty heavy helping of nostalgia, which I think taps into the emotional aspect of this game. And it's always been a part of the Super Bowl, but this year especially, people wanted to look back at a time before the pandemic, before the political strife and the social unrest. And so that's why you had, you know, Cheetos with that song from 2000, It Wasn't Me by Shaggy. That's why you had Cadillac referencing Edward Scissorhands. That's even why you had Huggies, frankly, showing newborn babies. It's all about these kind of positive, warm emotions, the hope, the nostalgia, the laughter that Super Bowl advertisers are banking on to kind of transfer over to their brands.
I thought one of the more effective uses of that was the Let's Grab a Beer ad, which really sort of, again, no pandemic, people are doing normal things, and they are relating to each other by, you know, a one-to-one conversation over a beer. And interestingly enough, I can't remember whose ad that was, but I thought it was, whose was that?
It was Anheuser-Busch.
Anheuser-Busch, you know, again, no Budweiser ads, but they did a lot of other things. Which, you know, it's the morning after. Which ad do you think, if any, was most effective in terms of attracting customers to buy stuff, which is obviously ultimately what they want?
So I always say that the ad effectiveness is in the eye of the beholder, but I actually have some statistics, because every year after the game, a bunch of metrics come out, and there's data from, I want to say it's the Kellogg School at Northwestern, that found that Cheetos, Amazon, Bud Light Seltzer with lemonade, Doritos, those were all highly effective ads.
Interesting. Jill, are you still there? I don't want to cut you off.
Did we lose you? Tiffany?
I'm still here.
This morning, I've talked to a couple of people who told me that the ad that struck them hardest was the Alexa Michael B. Jordan ad. I just got that reaction from you. What was your take on that ad?
I mean, I thought it was a funny ad. It was meant to be. There was some chatter about whether or not it was potentially a little too on the nose.
The opening line was rather risque.
Right. I mean, I had a lot of people texting me saying that was a really thirsty ad. But, you know, clearly a lot of people talked about it. It's showing up on a lot of rankings this morning.
What was the Klarna? Is it Klarna?
Klarna, yeah.
What was that about?
Maya Rudolph.
What did you think of that one?
You know, that one surprisingly stuck with a lot of people. That one's part of a batch of newcomer ads, advertisers, first-time advertisers in the Super Bowl. And a lot of people went into the ad saying, we don't know who Klarna is. But, you know, it's an online payments service provider. And I think a lot of people are going to remember that visual of four Maya Rudolph cowboys. Mm-hmm. And equate that with Klarna's business model. So in that sense, it was effective.
Tiffany, I'm curious, one of the things, and it may have happened in past Super Bowls, but I don't recall it happening, is there seemed to be a lot of kind of product placement, for lack of a better term, in the game highlights while the game was being played. Specifically like Nickelodeon, and where they had like the slime zone showing up. What did you think of that development?
So that's something that it isn't new to this year. There might have been some more of it, but that's something that a lot of advertisers will do in lieu of paying what this year was a $5.5 million price tag for 30 seconds in the ad breaks. This way they can just get a quick blip across the screen, their name gets mentioned, they're more tightly associated with the game.
That's an interesting segue. Tiffany, did we see more of CBS, Viacom, Paramount doing internal advertising in this game rather than selling it to paying advertisers? I mean, everything from the Nickelodeon thing, which I think is a Viacom company, to the and several times they would cut to the Super Bowl and have Romo and Romo's voice talking about the Paramount Mountain outside the stadium, which of course wasn't real. But again, a lot of internal CBS stuff. Did they sell less ads to outside people this year?
So there's data on that from, I believe it's Media Radar, where they found that in the game, 75% of the ads were paid, but 29 ads were Viacom CBS house ads, and 8 of those alone were for Paramount Plus. So there was a lot of CBS promoing happening during this game. That definitely wasn't your imagination.
And is that more than typical, Tiffany, do you know?
No, I don't have the historical data, but it's felt like more
yeah,
than
yeah, it sure did.
What
about another sort of, I thought, clever sequence was the Tide commercial with Jason Alexander. Is he getting a little bit sort of out of the mainstream in terms of, you know, Seinfeld's been off the air for 20 years. Is Jason Alexander someone that audiences still relate to? And do you think that was an effective ad?
You know, it was an interesting ad to me in terms of trends with celebrities this year. If you noticed, a lot of celebrities were shorn in kind of contorted positions, right?
Flat Matt.
Jason Alexander on the hoodie. There's Samuel L. Jackson in the Verizon ad as a video game character. There's Matthew McConaughey as like a flat, as a flattened version of himself. But someone made the comment last night that, and this applies to Jason Alexander, that last night's Super Bowl felt like a reunion of people who used to be on SNL, right? With Mike Myers and Dana Carvey from Uber Eats. They had, I can't remember who the host was, but the host from the previous or one of the more recent SNL episodes. It was a lot of folks who you wouldn't have thought of recently who were popping up in the ad breaks.
The Wayne's World ad I thought was... maybe it was clever, but it felt a little sad to me. I mean, those guys, you know, still in the basement at 60 years old. But anyway. anything else before we go? Tiffany, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you will come back and join us again next year with your observations on the Super Bowl. And, you know, maybe once we'll have a Super Bowl without Tom Brady. Who knows?
So much for having me.
Great conversation on the Super Bowl. And in the stock market, one of the Super Bowl events of the last couple weeks was what was happening with GameStop. Most of our audience has probably seen that. And we've got senior market commentator Michael Santoli from CNBC on the line with us to talk about GameStop. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, glad to do it. Thank you.
So it's received a lot of press. Just briefly, tell us what GameStop was and what happened in, you know, 15 seconds or 20 seconds or so.
Yeah, GameStop was and is a kind of a declining mall retailer of video games. And the stock attracted some genuine value investors, but then really took flight several weeks ago when it seems a lot of social media posting about how it could be engineered as a so-called short squeeze, because a lot of big investors had been betting against the stock, and therefore mechanically a lot of buying in the shares would have driven up the shares kind of exponentially as the big hedge funds covered their shorts. It played out. In fact, it worked as a short squeeze, but there's a limit to that, and now it has largely deflated from those levels after, in part, some restrictions were placed on some retail trading by Robinhood and other brokers.
You know, Michael, as I've followed the story and thought about the mechanics of what happened here, one of the things that intrigues me is, as I understand a short sale, you got to borrow the share from somebody. So somebody loaned a gazillion shares of GameStop to the various Reddits and others, people who, you know, to the various short sellers, to the various hedge funds. Who were those institutions that loaned all those shares, and aren't they the real winners in this story?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the stock loan is usually kind of a boring business. Big institutions that just have a bunch of stocks will just allow their brokers to lend it out and produce some income off of it. And in this case, you know, what seems as, to have happened when you get a very, very crowded short is the cost to borrow those shares goes up a lot. And therefore, in this case, there was, you know, almost, you know, astronomical cost to borrow those shares, 30, 50%. And then you're selling them short, assuming, I guess, if you're bearish, you think the stock can go towards zero. So it's certainly they made out to some degree on that. Now, the lot of questions have been surrounding just how the short position got to be so large. If you looked at some of the measures of it, it was as if more than 100% of the available traded shares were sold short. That can happen legally. The way to think about it is a short sale, you borrow from somebody, then you sell the stock. Therefore, it has another buyer or owner. And it, essentially, the same share is kind of owned by the same two people. And then, in fact, it can in turn be lent out again. So it almost creates new floated shares as the short position gets bigger. Nonetheless, there's a tremendous amount of stock borrowing on that one. And it was a very unique situation, I think, it really bears saying, that it's not as if this can be replicated across the market, because a lot of circumstances had to be in place for this to happen as it did in GameStop.
That's really interesting. So the way in which you can have more than 100% of short sale of stocks on a short side is if the same stock gets borrowed twice. Has that happened before? I mean,
It happens. It's not as if it's not unique. It's certainly extreme, and it often happens with far smaller stocks, I would guess. Now, the regulators and the trade groups and the exchanges try to make sure that there aren't abuses and there aren't people who are, you know, naked shorting, so to speak, without borrowing the stock. The other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, so much of the wild speculative activity in this stock and others has happened with investors, small investors, buying options on the stock. It's a lower cost leverage way to play the upside. Now, when that happens, the market makers, the dealers that facilitate that activity, they often, depending on the kinds of options trades, can short the stock as a hedge to keep themselves, you know, in a position to keep facilitating that market. They're allowed to do that without first borrowing the share. So there's a lot of moving parts to the calculations. But nonetheless, you know, the crowd was correct in saying that this was a situation vulnerable to a short squeeze. They don't always work, and certainly, as I said, they can't go on indefinitely, because in those 2 weeks, a tremendous amount of the hedge funds, they took their losses, they bought at higher prices to close out their shorts, and then the stock fell apart.
Yeah, and Michael, you'd mentioned earlier about the regulators when we were talking about how you can have more than 100% of the shares shorted. What do you think the regulators are going to do in this case? It's unusual in that, as you said, the crowd was correct. It was a crowd, and the crowd now has a way to talk to one another efficiently. We're seeing some semblance of this happening in the silver market again. Do you think we see the regulators step in pretty quickly? And what do you think they do to keep this from getting out of hand?
I think the main thing they're going to be looking for, and it's actually not all that black and white, is signs of genuine manipulation. Now, if you say, I really like GameStop shares, I think they're going higher, I think you all should buy some. That in itself is not manipulation, even if it's effective, even if it works to get the stock higher. I mean, I think there's a legal standard that says acting in concert, where everybody agrees to buy at a specific price and hold for the specific purpose of, you know, manipulating the stock price higher. That's something that I think that regulators are going to try to look at, but it's very delicate. I don't think they want to necessarily snuff out, you know, active, you know, discourse about stocks on Reddit or any other social network. I do think there has been some focus on one of the key, I guess, ambassadors for this trade in GameStop, who happens to have been a registered financial service professional. Right, he was kind of registered as a financial advisor or a broker, and the question is, did he breach some professional standards by doing this? I don't know if that's the case, but that's another thing they're going to look for. What I do think is interesting to note, though, you mentioned silver. That lasted all of half a day, because silver's a big global market, dominated by futures traders, dominated by, you know, an industry that buys and sells the physical metal, and it's just not that easy to say you can corner it, because, by the way, it wasn't even particularly heavily shorted. So I do think it shows you the limits there. And interestingly, with GameStop, I mean, I'm persuaded by these people who've looked at it and said the fact that it was a retailer that a lot of people had nostalgia for and that they wanted to rescue and felt as if the short sellers were being abusive and driving the stock out of business, the company out of business in a pandemic, so many things had to work together to get all that buying energy in that one place.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's my next question. We talked about the crowd, and to what extent, and you've touched on it in your previous response, but to what extent do you think this is a reflection of kind of the split, the divide that we're seeing in the country? And do you think this is the crowd saying, hey, what these hedge funds are doing, yes, they're making a ton of money, but it's just not right?
I think it certainly, it does reflect some of that that kind of reflexive dissatisfaction with institutions, with people who are in power, people who seem as if they have a lot of the advantages, systemic advantages. There's no doubt about that. But I also think that rhetoric was sort of adopted to a large degree by this crowd. I think it became, honestly, it became viral the way other things become viral, which is that nobody really knows why, and it just does. And so the algorithm just sort of surfaced it on a lot of people's screens. It became a TikTok thing. It became everywhere. And so I think that there was a, hey, we're all doing this thing. We're not really sure why we're all doing it, but here's a plausible story for why a lot of people think this is important to do, and it's to get at these, you know, people who are taking advantage. Now, one piece of context I think is really important is that it is easy to say these hedge funds have their way with the market, and they can drive down stocks at will, and they can make a fortune doing it, except it's not really true that it's been the case. Hedge funds in general have had very muted returns over the last several years. Short selling has been an awful strategy in general for the last few years, and it's not a particularly heavily shorted market. In fact, there's only, you know, GameStop and AMC and a few other of these companies are the exceptions that prove the rule, which is short interest in general is very low. People are very generally bullish about the market, or at least have kind of surrendered to the fact that this rally is, you know, has got legs. So it's interesting how the storylines develop that don't always really link up to the realities on the ground.
And I know we probably don't really have a way of knowing this, but I kind of wonder what happened to all those Reddit enthusiasts who, you know, bought the stock and it went up to the astronomical level. I kind of wonder if any of them got left holding the bag, you know, now that the stock has dropped down to $60. Do you think a lot of the small investors got burned in this little game?
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, there's no easy way to quantify it, but what typically happens, and it happened in this case, is as a stock really goes vertical and starts to just accelerate to the upside, and people get super excited about it. And by the way, people complaining that Robinhood wasn't letting them buy enough because the system was getting overwhelmed. When the stock reached toward $400, you can actually, there's a measure called the volume weighted average price. So the average price paid by these people, you know, backing huge volume in the stock was way over $300 for those last couple of days. And so what that tells you is there's a tremendous amount of latecomers who came by this idea and bought it at those levels and obviously are at least sitting on losses. I don't think it's been devastating to a tremendous number of people. You've seen some anecdotal things about certain folks who, you know, moved their Vanguard account all into to GameStop and lost, you know, tens of thousands. I don't think that's the rule. I think a lot of people were playing with amounts they could afford to lose. They almost thought of it as a high risk, high reward bet. But yeah, I think that somebody's shouldering this loss. Now, also, there were funds, there's professionals on both sides of this. Anytime a stock starts to move that aggressively, the machines sniff it out. They try to ride the momentum. So I think it's oversimplistic to say it was the amateur retail folks on Reddit on the buy side and the professionals on the sell side. I think everyone's on all sides of this one.
Well, Michael, that's a great note for us to end on. The algorithm sniffing out these patterns is a topic for another day that we'd love to chat with you on. Hopefully you'll join us again in the future. Our guest has been Michael Santoli. He is a senior markets commentator at CNBC. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Appreciate it.